Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, we've got the latest storm and stress from the 2016 presidential race. The Associated Press rocked the Clinton campaign's world this week after they released a report detailing new concerns about the Clinton Foundation, alleging that foundation donors got preferential access and treatment from Hillary Clinton's State Department. Over in the Trump campaign, they are working hard at the pivot they promised to make for months. And the most interesting thing that's emerged is that on the reality television host's signature issue, his draconian approach to immigration, Trump no longer seems to know what he either believes or says. Did Donald Trump mean it when he said his Republican rivals were soft on immigration? And if so, why does he suddenly seem to prefer the immigration policies of low-energy Jeb Bush? Meanwhile, a pharmaceutical company called Mylan is under fire this week after they raised the prices of their EpiPens. EpiPens are a device used by the severely allergic to prevent fatal allergy attacks. And Mylan raised the prices by 400%. Consumers are angry, as are members of Congress, who are demanding that Mylan reverse course and lower their prices. You know, if only that same Congress hadn't continually made policy decisions that allowed for these monopolistic practices in the first place. Finally, for some third-party perspective on our presidential race, we welcome back our favorite Bernie Sanders supporter, the always effervescent Tim Black of The Tim Black Show. We'll ask him if Clinton's managed to close the deal with him at all, and whether or not folks like him are having an impact on Democratic Party policies at all. I'm Jason Linkins with the Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Elise Foley. Here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of So That Happened, your podcast that digests and then regurgitates all of the pain in the world of politics so that you can more easily masticate it. I'm Jason Lickens. I'm the editor of Eat the Press, and we have a doozy of a show today, and we're going to kick things off by attempting to work our way through a web of confusion that has recently engulfed the 2016 race. And joining us to talk about this is Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
He's always here. And also here as a special guest is our pal Elise Foley.
Woohoo.
Yes, Elise, you are here to help us because you are an immigration reporter, among other things. I know you wear many hats and many...
That's my main hat.
Your main hat. Many of hats and some fascinators.
This is my biggest hat.
This is your biggest hat. And you have had to, I guess, pull a lot of rabbits out of that hat this week because...
This hat analogy is working.
Yeah, so far,
expected.
So good. It's gonna derail at some point, so let's enjoy it while we're still doing it.
10-gallon hat.
Yes. Donald Trump has recently begun the, I think, 37th pivot of his campaign. And this one has had kind of a laser focus on immigration, which is, of course, in many ways his raison d'etre for the whole thing. He seems to have said a bunch of things that tend to contradict themselves this week. Am I crazy for thinking that?
You are not crazy for thinking that.
Yes.
I think the summary would be that he's been saying things that contradict himself for ages. And now it's finally sort of coming out because he's supposedly going to put out some sort of more clear policy proposals. And so now he's sort of having to backpedal on some of the stuff that he said before and also claim that he's not changing his mind at all, which is a fun thing that politicians always do.
Well, where did it start? It started sometime last year. Was it the wall?
Or yeah, he started with the wall, his very first speech. And he talked then about people crossing the border are terrible rapists, criminals, et cetera. Mexicans specifically are those things, according to him. But then he started fairly soon saying that you have to get them all out, referring to undocumented people. He said that, yeah, we'll be rounding them up. Oh, are you going to send, he was asked, are you going to send children too? And he said, yeah, we have to send the whole family. So he was pretty clear that he wanted every undocumented person to leave. He said some of them could come back. Now, all of a sudden, it sounds like he is not going to propose that you have to deport everyone. I think he's also not going to propose that you should, you know, allow people to stay explicitly by letting them stay legally, but perhaps just allow them to stay in this kind of hazy gray area that they're staying in right now.
And so there's a Trump deportation force that he's stipulated will be in charge of all of this.
Yes, he said that there was going to be. Then this weekend, his campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway. Sorry about that. She was on TV and was asked about the deportation force, and she said, to be determined. So that was one of the things that sort of set off the speculation that he's about to do or is currently doing this massive flip-flop.
There's another part, though, which is also the Muslim ban.
Yes.
Which I think he actually put this on a piece of paper in December, I think.
Yeah, this was not an off-the-cuff remark when he first proposed it. They put out a statement.
Right. Level of serious 100, because it's written on paper, and he, like, had the piece of paper up at his lectern and said, we will have a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the country.
From country, but
he's pivoted on that one, though.
Yeah, yeah.
These were later pivots.
Yes. Yeah, so later he said, actually, it'll be from countries compromised by terrorism. And it's like, what does that mean? Yeah, exactly. And I think what it means to him is Muslim countries. He just isn't saying that anymore. But then it was kind of funny. I know he went on TV and said, actually, he was expanding it. But then,
right.
So it's kind of been trying to play it both ways, you know, not say he's shrinking it, but.
So here's one theory.
Also change it.
Here's one theory, and maybe I'm crazy, or maybe this is so obvious that I should just accept it, but is one possibility that Donald Trump is attempting to massage his positions when he's in discussions with, say, elite reporters or audiences of these, you know, the so-called centrist people that he needs to reach in order to move past this, like, sort of high 30s, low 40s ceiling he's been at the polls, while at the same time reserving the right whenever he's at a rally, let's say, to paperback over those milder comments and say, I'm just as ruthless as I ever was, in the hopes that he keeps his core supporters at home while bringing new people on. Is that part of what's going on? Because it seems to me like it is in some ways a con. You know, I've either lied to the people who supported me from the outset, or I'm lying to more centrist-minded people now.
I think that is a legitimate theory. I have another theory
I'll offer,
which is that Donald Trump's understanding of the details of immigration enforcement policy was never very sophisticated.
Okay.
So he made a lot of comments like, round them all up, deport everybody. Now he is, has these people working for him who know a lot more about things. Most people who actually know a lot about immigration policy would never say that you're going to deport 11 million people in 2 years because that's just not
possible.
Practical.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you think that it's the right thing to do, it's not. You're not going to do it. It's just not going to happen. So I think that what happened is he made all these statements. Now he is getting kind of clued in, perhaps, or, you know, people are telling him that it's not going to work. And so now he's remembering what he
said. I have a third theory.
Yeah, what's your third theory? Let's just stack up the theories, man. That's what I'm all about.
My theory is that because he's just flat out losing right now, losing bad, causing red states to turn blue, that he's scrambling to moderate his past immigration positions. That the pace of pivoting has increased, and the number of changes and caveats has increased in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I mean, on immigration, all of his, you know, hardline supporters, a lot of them cheer about, you know, deport them all. But polling shows that most, even Republicans, think that there should be some way for undocumented people who have been here a long time to stay. So it's not a stupid pivot if that's what he's trying to do.
I have to say, though, there's part of it that kind of like goes against the sort of central claim of his candidacy in the first place, the whole I alone can solve things. You know, he positioned himself as a guy who was by several degrees smarter and better and more prepared to be president than any of the stupid losers who currently live in Washington, D.C. And now it seems that most of what's driving his softening of positions are that he's listening to the fucking stupid losers he decried in the first place. Are we witnessing consultitis finally take root in the Trump camp?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't know if I have that much to add to that. I think that that is true.
You know what that sounds like to me? It sounds like hypocrisy alert.
There we go. Yes, I think that's the very first time we ever had a hypocrisy alert on the show. Which
hypocrisy
is
alert.
Which is unusual. Unusual since I sit next to you and you issue the hypocrisy alert all the time.
Hypocrisy alert!
Not directed at me, but at other people. The other thing I think people have noticed is that he may be sort of like staking out a unique position where it's all about the wall now. It's all about the wall. And I forget who wrote this. I think it was Jonathan Chait said that, ironically, what Donald Trump is proposing, if he backs off mass deportation and goes solely at securing the southern border, that he's really just the candidate of the status quo on that in that regard. Because that's always been the sort of extant promise laid before policymakers. We're going to have some path to citizenship that's reasonable, but the trade-off is you've got to give Republicans the opportunity to build a lot of security theater on the southern border to sort of satisfy their – well, not just satisfy their – I guess their desires, but satisfy a lot of what their constituents tell them they want.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened in 2013 when the Senate passed that big immigration reform bill. It had a path to citizenship, but then it also had just like this massive ramp up of border security that even the Republicans, some of them said was overkill, but they wanted it anyway.
Most of these debates are really just the chicken egg thing. What comes first, the path or the security, right?
Or just ramp up the border and do nothing. I mean, there's not necessarily a combination there.
Also, in the past week, didn't Trump or one of his subordinates explicitly say, yeah, we just want to deport the criminals? And it was like, wow, that's exactly what we're doing. That's the current policy.
They even praised Barack Obama's deportation policy, which is not something
it's unreal. I mean,
that Republicans should say out loud.
Yeah, Donald Trump said in the same interview the other day that actually Obama's deported huge numbers of people. And then he also said, well, we're not doing anything. It's like, you gotta pick.
Yeah, what's going on?
What's Obama doing? Nothing or too much?
This
election
is over. It's over.
I think that Donald Trump figures he doesn't have to pick. He may be really literally attempting to have everything both ways and just see if he can like turn out votes that he desperately needs.
He's been doing that for a while, and it seems to have
it's worked during the primaries.
Worked for a while, yeah. And now isn't anymore. But yeah, I mean, trying to have it both ways seems to be his thing.
All right. Well, I think we're going to probably have more perambulations on the immigration issue going forward. So we'll have reason to have at least back on to soothe our frayed nerves and calm us down and explain what is happening. So thanks for that.
You're welcome. I'll keep my hat.
I'm sorry I yelled so much today.
No, it's okay. No, you didn't. That's all right, Arthur. That's all right, Arthur. And yeah, definitely thanks. Thanks for like landing the hat callback, because I forgot about that. I'm glad to have someone more conscientious than me here podcasting with us. Okay, well, we have a very nice show. It's a very nice show. It's a pleasant and dignified show where we talk about politics with a lot of professionalism and dignity. And you want to stick around and listen to that, right? So don't move at all. Don't press stop. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So So, hey, everybody. I have Elise Foley back with me.
What's up?
So, literally hours after we recorded the segment, Donald Trump went out and changed his immigration policies again.
Policies, tone,
rhetoric.
Unclear, rhetoric yeah, for sure.
It's still super unclear.
So unclear.
But it seemed to me...
But it's an update.
It is an update. And God knows we're going to finish recording this and tomorrow it's going to change again. But it really seemed to me, at least, that in his appearance on Wednesday evening, that Donald Trump really seemed to be now suddenly talking about immigration and immigration reform in the way that his vanquished primary rivals did in arguing against him. He sounded like Marco Rubio. He sounded like Jeb Bush, low energy Jeb Bush.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the talking points he was using were certainly really similar. I mean, all week he's been talking about, we are going to get the criminals out so fast. Then we're going to figure out what to do. I mean, those are not controversial policy positions. Most pro-reform people will talk about, oh, you have to deport criminals and then we'll figure out something to do with undocumented immigrants. Now he's sort of saying that same thing instead of deport them all. And it's totally the same rhetoric. I would say policy-wise, I think it's probably going to be very different. So I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's fair to like Jeb Bush to say that Donald Trump and Jeb Bush are the same. But it is striking the way he's talking about it, how similar it is.
His spokeswoman, Christina Pearson, literally said the policy hasn't changed. He's just using different words.
I mean, yeah, that's just like he's lying now or was before.
It seems insane that we're even having to contend with this.
Yeah, I mean, I find this whole thing very frustrating because we're having to parse a bunch of words and not have, you know, any policy. One of the things last night the way he spoke about it was a lot of it wasn't really declarative. It was just questions. He was polling the crowd and he said, do you think we should do this? and then do you think that maybe for somebody who's been here 25 years and they haven't done anything wrong, maybe we should do this? Sort of presenting that opening. And I think the fact that he presented that opening is maybe for justification in the future to say, look, this is what the people want. At the same time, I think we should, at the time of this recording, he has not yet said that he wants legal status for undocumented people.
Fair.
HuffingtonPost.com.
For the continuing updates changes. On this, I'll say really hilariously, last night, Ann Coulter was having her book release party for her new book, In Trump We Trust. And one
hilarious
of the things,
timing.
Yes. One of the things she says in this book is that she literally says Trump can be forgiven anything except changing his position on immigration reform. And last night on Twitter, she kind of freaked out because what she heard Trump saying was that I support amnesty and in the way that Ann Coulter thinks of things as amnesty.
Right. I mean, yeah, she thinks of almost anything as amnesty. I believe, though, that she's coming around and trying to figure out the right way to defend him, stay on the Trump train.
It must be super fun to have to go through that convoluted process. If it's fun for us to have to cover it, I don't even know how we would begin to do like just a timeline of Trump's like utterations on immigration.
I've been trying.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world. Let me know if I can help, okay?
I will. Yeah.
All right, cool.
We'll be here all night.
All right, so that's the up-to-the-minute update on Trump's immigration policies. They will change probably the minute we leave the studio, so sorry about that. It's not our fault. We'll be right back. Welcome once again, and we have with us Arthur Delaney.
Hey.
And Zachary Carter.
Hello.
How you guys doing?
You know, I'm sort of waking up from my
tent, right?
Place where I live and sleep is a tent in the studio. So I'm good.
That's not true.
Important callback. The Clinton Foundation is, let's stipulate a couple things before we start talking about the Clinton Foundation, which has been the target of new scrutiny and deserved scrutiny, I feel. But let's stipulate a couple things. Obviously, running a charitable foundation is the sort of thing that you don't normally – you normally say that's a fine thing for an ex-president like Bill Clinton to do. He cultivated a lot of contacts around the world. He made a lot of friends. He could possibly do a lot of good, blah, blah, blah. Let's also say about the Clinton Foundation that the kind of agencies that govern govern and regulate and administer grades on charitable foundations like Charity Navigator, they've all said that the Clinton Foundation is a good charity. That said.
However.
So in other words, they give money to poor people.
People have received mosquito netting and the like, and it's not some kind of like scam charity like a Wyclef Jean Haiti thing where it's like money going to like a few people and it never arrives where it's supposed to land. However, Bill Clinton's wife was a Secretary of State and is running for president. And so it is a very weird thing to exist when everyone knew at the founding of the Clinton Foundation that Hillary Clinton would run for president in this cycle and be Secretary of State.
And she was the top diplomat for the American government for years.
And I feel like we have had Zephyr teach out on the show numerous times. And I feel like we kind of owe it to her and to our listeners to sort of apply the Zephyr Teachout standard of legal corruption, which is to say that any arrangement that even appears to be the kind of thing that might facilitate corruption is in and of itself bad for democracy. Have I got any of that wrong?
That's not a Zephyr. I mean, that is this. Even in the law, the appearance of.
And by the way, this is not just Zephyr's. This is not just Zephyr's opinion
basic
on that. This is founders' 100
years of anti-corruption thinking.
It can't look
that
bad. It
goes back to Louis Brandeis before he was even on the Supreme Court.
Yes. So the Clinton Foundation.
It's misleading to call the Clinton Foundation a charity. The Clinton Foundation does a lot of good work, but it is still a political organization. It is a global political organization. And if you think that the dictators and oppressive regimes that are giving millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation are doing so because they think it is the most efficient way to alleviate poverty in the developing world, I think you are out of your damn mind.
I agree.
There's a reason why these people give money to the foundation. And the fact that the Clinton campaign right now is saying that they will divorce themselves from the agency if she is president for the agency. Sorry, this is how much I don't think it should be considered a charity from the foundation if she is president. Reveals that there's something that everybody now acknowledges was fishy about her being the top diplomat for the United States government while this foundation was still accepting donations from people
this week. The bombshell story was from the Associated Press, in which they, you know, counted up people who'd had meetings with Clinton and found that, like, half of a certain subcategory of people who'd had these meetings had also given money
and
to the Clinton Foundation.
Just to be specific, the AP has taken some heat, and I think perhaps rightly, for failing to properly categorize the denominator of the people they were talking about as a subcategory.
Right.
Their initial headline read that literally a percentage of everyone Clinton had met with had donated money to the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
To be fair, within the story, they were quite transparent.
They were transparent within the story.
I thought this was used against the story unfairly, and the people like criticizing the story are essentially saying what elites say, which is that you don't understand how diplomats work.
I'm only speaking as a guy criticizing the packaging of the story, that they could have done a better job and not taken on a little bit of water, because the story's good.
Yeah.
And
good point.
What they've pointed out is good, but they need to get there. They need to properly – everyone. The editorial mission is to properly define terms and define them quickly in a piece so readers get it, and so that misinformation does not get construed. And that's been a problem with the story. But it's really, to my mind, the only problem with the story.
Half of the private citizens who met with Clinton in this subcategory of meetings and schedules that the AP was able to obtain, which, by the way, they had to sue the federal government to get that information.
Correct.
Because the State Department doesn't just disclose who they meet with. Within that category of private citizens, half of them were Clinton Foundation donors.
That looks terrible.
There you go.
That looks terrible.
Excellent summation, Zach. It does look terrible.
And so what you're seeing from Clinton's defenders in which is quickly becoming this sort of like weird DNC Breitbart.
It's become a Rorschach test.
Yeah, that's happening where people are like, okay, well, we cannot prove that Hillary Clinton took $500,000 in cash from this person and then agreed in her heart of hearts that while she had never wanted to do a corrupt thing before, she would now do the corrupt thing because she had the $500,000 in cash in an envelope. That's not the way the Democratic Party has thought about corruption for 100 years.
Yeah, correct.
But now we see all of these Democratic Party partisans saying, essentially the logic of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision from 2010 where if you cannot demonstrate an explicit quid pro quo between the giving of cash and the execution of a deed, that that there is no corruption going on.
And we get back to what Zephyr's been talking about, by the way, all along, which is that we've defined down the idea of political corruption into something that's so rare and remote and difficult to prove in itself that we're letting all kinds of things just fly under the rug.
Like it has to be a crumpled up paper bag with three different grease stains on it.
Yeah.
With the fingerprints of a dictator stained in the blood of the innocents who they strangled with you.
You have to construct a TikTok by which money changed hands and a deed was executed almost immediately, and it's got to be knowing and intentional, blah, blah, blah.
But look,
the simple fact of the matter is, like, right off the bat, with this, what we see in the instance of the Clinton Foundation, is that money talks, and it gets you access.
Yeah,
and this is not access that ordinary people enjoy. I can't go to the State Department with my desperate need and get them to listen to me. Now, if I had what I've learned is that if I had made a significant donation to the Clinton Foundation, I may have had an outside shot at that during her tenure. And that is, even if I don't get quid pro quo on the outside, I still get a political benefit from having money and access.
Now, what's so awkward and weird about this story is that there's you want to equate it to something on the other side, naturally, if you're a journalist, and there's the, like, Trump University scams and all that, which this is not like at all.
No, it's not.
No. And totally different kind of scam.
And it can't be. One of the reasons it can't be is because Donald Trump really did not cultivate the kind of political influence that Hillary and Bill Clinton did during their lifetimes. Donald Trump is a small player in this world. All of his scams are sui generis and they popped out of his fucking head. He didn't traipse across the world trying to cultivate the attention of elites and promising to do them favors. In fact, he was pretty bad at it when he was trying when other people were going into Russia to build fancy hotels. Donald Trump failed to really make
I had more in mind the fact that he just bilked people out of their money.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Donald Trump is more like a shady payday lender,
and
the Clinton Foundation
artist.
Is more like a too big to fail Wall Street bank.
But before we wrap though, if there's no like legit quid pro quo, what are some of the examples that people have cited as de facto problems that Clinton now faces?
Look, it's just the quid pro quo question. The AP story is not the first time people have found problems with the Clinton Foundation.
No, absolutely
not. Okay?
Yeah.
Last year, the New York Times did an excellent investigation in which they found that Bill Clinton himself had been paid $500,000 to give a speech, and the foundation had received millions of dollars by interests that were Russian interests that were trying to acquire American uranium. And the State Department was one of several agencies that signed off on this Russian effort to acquire a fifth of the American uranium stock. Now, uranium is used for nuclear weapons, okay? Was this because Hillary Clinton was fundamentally corrupt and she just saw that, oh, the Russians are going to pay Bill $500,000 and therefore we should give them all of our uranium? Was this because there was, you know, were national security ideas that were floating around at the time that said we should be nice to the Russians and give them stuff that is used to make nuclear weapons?
Right.
I don't know. But you should not be in a position to have to ask those types of questions. It is absolutely outrageous that there are people within the Democratic Party are defending that kind of behavior and saying that nothing wrong and nothing untoward happened. It's gross and it should not be going on. And they should wind down the foundation.
I think they're going to do that. But can I also say that we've been focusing on like corrupt regimes and dictators and that kind of thing. Corporations also play a big role in the Clinton Foundation universe. And I've sort of always characterized the Clinton Foundation as one of those places where our beloved brands can do a lot of karma laundering. By donating to charitable foundations and getting a lot of good PR that covers over or papers over or adds to the balance on the other side of the shit they do.
This is a problem with big philanthropy more generally with the Gates Foundation.
Yeah, and there's evidence that while Clinton was at State Department, she gave benefits to UBS, the bank from Switzerland. And I feel like there's attention needs to be paid on the corporate side of this too. It's not just corrupt regimes, bad actors from around the world that we maybe shouldn't be doing business with. We're talking about also brands here at home and respected corporate brands that have parlayed their ability to provide a sort of tiny dollop of charity into big PR coups and enrich their connections to powerful people in government. And potentially, obviously, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, those connections remain, whether they wind down the Clinton Foundation or not. So one of the things you should look to for the AP to do is to properly identify the people they've put on that list, to actually put out the names, because those are people that journalists can literally track the history of, what they've done, their dealings with Congress, who they've met with, and what they've gained from it, and what they could stand to gain from in the future. And I hope the AP does actually produce the list. I understand why they may not want to do right now, because they're in competition with the rest of us trying to find this stuff out. But I hope that further journalism going down the line focuses on those people and what they've done in the past and what they stand to do in the future, because there's a whole big map of web of corruption you can draw from that.
Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back. And we're back, and we have another great story of corruption and grossness for everybody to chew on. EpiPens. Got one? Need one? Well, guess what? It could come at a dearer cost than normal because of a terrible thing that's happening at the nexus of government corruption and corporate flim-flammery. Arthur Delaney is here to tell us about what the fuck happened this week with EpiPens.
Oh, well, there's a company called Mylan. And they, over the course of several years, have jacked the price of EpiPens 600%. And people are pissed because this is something you have to buy if your child has severe allergies. Because you know, you get stung by a bee or you accidentally eat a peanut.
Go into anaphylactic shock.
Yeah, you could use die.
And the EpiPen,
so you carry an EpiPen, you jam it into your thigh.
Yeah.
Zach Carter, by the way, joining Arthur.
Oh, sorry.
And
yeah, I never introduced Zach.
You jam it into your thigh and then you don't die. So it's a good drug. It does it has a real good, real, you know, social good here. It's life saving, but it's the same drug that it was in 2007,
yeah.
And somehow the price has gone up 500 or 600%.
So just to make something pointedly clear, this product has also been one that over the course of many years, public schools have become required to have in stock in their school nurse department.
Yeah, the company has lobbied to change the laws to make it so that these are in all the schools.
So public schools have to procure these things, too, in many instances.
Yeah, and you have to buy them in a two-pack. So they've done all these things that have made it – that happen to be more profitable.
So you have a captive customer base and a unique product. I wonder what might happen to the price of that product.
So there's been so much outrage over this massive price hike. It's now like $500 per pen.
And what was it before?
If you don't have insurance.
What was it before?
About 100.
About 100.
So, you know, members of Congress are calling for oversight. You know, the Obama administration said they're, you know, the company's greedy, but of course they're doing nothing because they don't do anything.
And the Clinton campaign denounced the price increases.
Right. It's
which,
just like with Martin Shkreli and
yeah.
his, you know, immune system helping drug.
That yes.
He, so listen to Mylan's CEO, Heather Bresch, in an interview on CNBC.
So, look, no one's more frustrated than me. I've been in this business for 25
years. But you're the one
raising
the price, though. How can you be frustrated?
My frustration is there's a list price of $608. There is a system. I laid out that there are four or five hands that the product touches and companies that it goes through before it ever gets to that patient at the counter. No one, everybody should be frustrated. I am hoping that this is an inflection point for this country. Our healthcare is in a crisis.
Now, here's a fun fact about Heather Bresch. Who wants to tell everyone the fun fact about Heather Bresch? It's a really fun fact. You guys are going to have so much fun with this. It's so much fun.
Her dad is a guy named Joe Manchin, who is a Democratic senator from West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, how about that?
So, may have been helpful. I mean, there's nothing automatically evil about that.
But there is something that's sort of aesthetically appropriate, because the reason that these drug companies can charge these absurd prices is because the federal government grants them monopolies. They either do that by granting them patents, which say explicitly nobody else is allowed to do anything with this, or in the case of Mylan and EpiPen, by having a pretty lousy sort of generic drug approval system, which has prevented generics from coming to the market. So the reason Mylan is able to just jack up the price is not because, oh, they had to spend so much money lobbying the government and marketing, as Heather Bresch just suggested in that clip. It's because they just can. They have no competitors. They just can do it.
I think what's illustrative about this is that she talks about, in order to deflect this criticism, all the different things that go into the creation of the product, the different hands that touch it, you know, development, selling to pharmacies. It's nonsense.
Yeah.
It's just to distract you from the fact that the price went up for no reason.
But, you know, the fact that she's also the daughter of a senator also speaks to the way this matter is going to be treated by Congress. When Martin Shkreli pissed the world off, they dragged his ass into Congress and read him the Riot Act. And they didn't treat him with kid gloves, even though I don't think that a lot of the people who interrogated him really truly knew what they were talking about when they were doing so. But you should expect, I believe, Heather Bresch to be treated a lot more lightly by Congress, if at all.
Well, they've been putting out some harsh statements. I mean, the Manchin Senate office has said, like, we're not commenting on this right now.
Harsh statements are the easiest currency.
Well,
in
she is being summoned to the Hill.
Okay, well,
to make a Shkreli-like appearance.
Well, that's the proving ground for all of this.
But here's the thing: there are federal policies which make this happen, and everybody can scream bloody murder every time a pharmaceutical company abides by the law and exploits it to screw people over. But nobody actually wants to change the law. And in fact, the Obama administration and most of the Republican establishment want to make this problem worse by pushing through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a big trade deal which creates longer and stronger drug monopolies in the developing world, which will also create upward pressure on pricing in the United States.
And they recently did this with Obamacare.
Yes, part of Obamacare, in fact, is this interesting sort of detente between the administration and the pharmaceutical industry, where they say, "Hey, you know how Kathleen Sebelius, who's the head of Health and Human Services, when she was governor of Kansas, she had this cool program where senior citizens, if they wanted to get prescription drugs from Canada, where they cost like a tenth as much as they do in the United States,
right.
They could just do that." They could just order them.
So if
and the Obama administration said, we will stop doing stuff like that if the pharmaceutical companies will just please go along with Obamacare, please.
Right.
So essentially, the administration has been doing this, giving pharma a carte blanche since it got into office, basically because they didn't lobby against Obamacare. It's great that they didn't lobby against Obamacare. Is it great that they have these monopolies over life-saving drugs?
Not really.
So you're the little guy. You're not rich. You're out there on Main Street. Which party's got your back?
Nobody.
Yeah, nobody.
Nobody.
One of the things, the Clinton campaign, like I said, put out a statement about that. It's been characterized as she's demanded that they reduce the price. And other people have said, we demand that you reduce the price of this drug. This is bad. Even Chuck Grassley says, this is bad. The price should be lower. Should make the lower. I feel like... Like legislators in these instances and policymakers and politicians in instances have been dragged right up to the line of a revelation about what should happen. These guys are all sort of demanding the price go down, but their appeal is basically out of the kindness of your heart and decency, bring the price down.
You being Heather Bresch.
Heather Bresch only. In this one instance, bring the price down. I'm looking for some to maybe make the very next step in the logic of what they're saying. These legislatures have the instinct to say it would be politically good for me to demand the price go down. They haven't yet figured out we have consolidated political power and can pass laws.
What am I going to do? I'm only in Congress.
I'm just like, what's the obvious solution here? What's the obvious solution here? And here's the hint. All your friends in Canada have figured it out.
Well, here's...
Obama administration do by itself if it wanted to?
Even without passing new laws about intellectual property, in a case like what we're seeing with the EpiPen and Mylan, there's an agency called the Federal Trade Commission, which is designed to protect consumers against anti-competitive practices by monopolistic organizations.
Right.
The FTC could just lower the price. They could just say this is a problem. They can regulate the pricing. They can force Mylan to be broken up into different companies. They can force them to divest their rights to distribute EpiPens. They can do all sorts of things. The FTC could just fix this now if they wanted to.
But they don't want to.
No.
Almost as if they're a compromised agency.
It's almost like we don't enforce antitrust laws in the United States anymore. I mean, aside from the intellectual property issues here, this is a clear case of EpiPen being too big to fail, and as we say in the banking world, and there's an agency that's designed to deal with that, and it's time for them to do their job.
All right, nobody's more frustrated than me.
Correct.
No, it would be correct if it was nobody's more frustrated than I.
No one is more frustrated than he.
Yes, no one is more frustrated than Arthur. I think we've established that. And everything else is fucked up. So use your power, Congress, to actually do the right thing. And we'll be right back. And welcome back. Hey, joined once again by Arthur Delaney.
Hey.
And coming to us over the phone, one of our favorite people, Rye and always on the mark, we have Tim Black, the host of the Tim Black Show, which is a conveniently named show. They made the show and they found a Tim Black and he's good. Tim Black, welcome. Welcome to Said That Happened. Welcome back to Said That Happened.
Hey, man. Thank you guys for having me once again. I appreciate it. Much love, Jason and Arthur.
All right. We're glad to have you. So, the last time we talked, I think we were just getting into the nominations were now set in stone. And so this race that we've been watching has had a little bit of time to breathe. I think that it's been obviously this guy scary or this woman scary as far as the top two major candidates have been back and forth. We've seen some traction gained by third party people in the polls, both Jill Stein and Gary Johnson have started to congeal a little bit of support, maybe something to build on. As this race has kind of like opened up a little bit, we've got a little breathing room. What do you think is going on, Tim?
Man, it's historical, man. This is great. I like the fact that we got more options. We got more people to continue the conversation. I'm not going to say I'm in favor of Gary Johnson, but I like the fact that he's out there. That's right. Give it to him. Make the Republicans work for it. Make the Democrats work for it. Same thing for Jill Stein. I got to admit, I'm really feeling the love. I'm feeling her campaign of policies and what she's all about. So I think this is good for democracy, good for the people.
So, Tim Black, when we last spoke, maybe a month ago, you were favoring Jill Stein, but you weren't shutting the door on Hillary Clinton. You said you'd listen to what she has to say, and you were willing to be convinced that she is as progressive as she says.
Has she done it?
Has she made the case?
Emphatic. No, she hasn't done it, man. She hasn't. Like, she hasn't won me over. She's just Hillary, man. I mean, look, man, we got all these emails dropping on the Clinton Foundation. That's not good. That's not a good thing. We got people up here with the rumors about her health. I'm looking at stuff about concussions and other. I don't know what's going on with her, you know. I'm looking at Trump. I'm wondering what's up with Trump and her. And Jill's side just seems more steady for when it comes to policy, she's more aligned with. It's just a natural segue from Bernie to Jill. It's a little bit more left, but it's still in the same wheelhouse. But Hillary hasn't done it for me, man. I'm sorry to report.
Now, that makes a lot of sense, but the one thing surprised me, the Hillary Clinton health problem story has come out of the right-wing fever swamp. Do you believe that she's got undisclosed health problems? Like, she's, like, can't even stand up and is, like, a Weekend at Bernie's dead body that is being marionetted through the campaign?
Love that analogy, man. No, I don't think she's... Obviously, she's alive. It's the people who try to testify against her who aren't. Bam! But no, man. There are some questions. Now, to be fair, both Trump and Hillary have released less information than any other candidates in recent history regarding their health. And if the advanced age of 70 for Trump and 68 for Clinton, respectively, that's not good. I mean, we want to know more about these people and, you know, what's going to happen, because I definitely don't want a Pence as a VP, and nor do I want a milquetoast Mike Kane.
Well, to defend Donald Trump, his doctor did say that he was the most healthiest human that ever lived, or some nonsense in that. He was an Adonis.
Specific.
That born from the sun and sent to Earth. So you've been paying attention. I would say you've had your eye on the third party game probably pretty intensely. I don't know if you've ever sort of read the way your Beltway pundits try to talk about third parties. It seems to me that what always happens, and what's happening with Jill Stein and what's happening with Gary Johnson, is that we find that there are people who feel they've been underserved by the current party system that go looking for alternatives. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this phenomenon. I was wondering if you had anything wry or interesting to say about it. But I found that, like, when your big media pundits talk about third parties and the need for third parties, there's sort of this generic agreement with maybe people at street level who notice the two-party system isn't serving them anymore. But it seems to me that here in the Beltway, when people talk about third parties, they always sort of seem to imagine the kind of people that would naturally accrue to a third party, and they always tend to be the most overserved people in politics already. Like, we had the former editor-in-chief of Politico talk about there needs to be an innovation party where Silicon Valley people should congeal. And I was just like, Silicon Valley people are getting all they want out of politics right now. They don't need a party. What do you think is the natural reason for why there's, like, such a divide over, like, Beltway groupthink on third parties and the way people actually behave when they encounter the two-party system we're in?
Wow, man. You know, as far as the Beltway gateway, I don't know, man. I think that there's always going to be a hunger for different voices, especially when I consider the fact that we're looking at the party system as it stands. It's to me, it's like Republican light. I'm sorry, guys. I just don't feel like we really have a liberal wing anymore within our system. They've moved too far to the right. So I think that exists. But as far as, like, what our Silicon Valley folks need, hey, they've got money. So if you got money, your money's always going to talk. They can pretty much invest in any candidate based on the way our system's set up and get some type of exposure to the issues that concern them. But what concerns me about third parties, when I look at, particularly for the Green Party, when I look at these guys, I'm watching their debates. I'm seeing people with seashells on their shirts and dashikis. And I'm like, come on, guys, we need to be a little bit more mainstream. So there's some work that needs to be done on the third party side, where they need to come into the light, so to speak, so they could be more palatable for people who would vote normally Republican or Democrat. I don't think the Libertarians have that problem, but definitely the Green Party, they do. But they did choose two, even though Ajamu Baraka, Jill Stein's VP, does have some more, I would say, outspoken standpoints, he's still more palatable than many of the other candidates she could have chosen.
At the after the conventions in which, you know, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump locked it up, Jill Stein had some unfavorable headlines over comments on vaccines. And she didn't make her – I mean, she was not outright saying they cause autism, but it seemed like she was pandering to that idea.
I love the fact that they tried to make this an issue, because it shows that she was getting a little bit of traction, man. They got to push back. Jill Stein's not anti-vax. She's a doctor. She just believes that the people who approve your drugs shouldn't be the same people who make your drugs and sell your drugs. Like, you need to break that up a little bit. The people that make your Tonka truck didn't also approve it as safe for the kids. So that's sort of like what we have. We have the, where I come from, the the wolves don't guard the hen house, man, and that's sort of the setup that we have currently. And we should just be able to make sure we have a viable third entity, an entity outside the body that's able to look and say, hey, is this really what kids need? Is the schedule correct? What about the, you know, consecutive nature of the vaccinations? Is this rigorous, you know, program? Is this better for the kids? And what are the results from that? Different countries do it different ways. So we should be able to examine that, but I don't believe she's anti-vax. I spoke to her twice. I've interviewed Jill Stein twice, and in my last meeting I asked her, and she emphatically said no. She just wanted to protect our rights and look out for the people.
Fair enough. The one of the more interesting things that I've found happening in this race is that we definitely see that Donald Trump has like caused a cleavage in the Republican base between the kind of Republicans who sort of like chase corporate power, your Chamber of Commerce Republicans, and suddenly people who now identify as conservative but do see a purpose in government redistributing money and government programs, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if there's a similar force happening on the left where there are now louder voices both inside the party and adjacent to the party in the form of disaffected liberals that are like urging the Democratic Party to stop chasing after the professional class and satisfying their needs ahead of all others and to stop trying to get corporate America to quote unquote like them as much as they appear to like the Republicans. Do you feel like in some short term there could be some kind of transformation, or are we going to just get through another election and settle back into the old tropes?
Oh, man, this is my hope upon hopes, my brother. This is what I'm looking for. I want to move. Like, you know, it's better to use a house that's already built if you can do that. You know, it's better to build it from the floor up. I know there are people who fancy themselves. They want to go destroy the Democratic Party. Look, it's been around for a while. It's going to continue to exist. We just need to refurbish it. Let's put some new carpet in there. Let's knock out these, you know, let's spray for termites. Let's get some paint out here. But no, I agree with you 100%, man. What we need to do is hopefully influence the party to make new decisions. Bernie Sanders has ignited people across the country, across the globe, actually. And I think that's good for the party. I think in the end, it will be a positive thing. Now what we have to do is continue to hold, not only, you know, we talk a lot about presidents, but it's also about down ticket folks.
Yeah.
I'm watching Florida. I talked to Tim Canova. I had him on the show.
He's a good guy. For him.
Yeah, he is, man. And we need to support down ticket folks like Tim Canova and help them, you know, win their seats so that we can fundamentally change what goes on, not only in the White House, but on the state and local level.
Yeah. Yeah. Good advice. People should listen to Tim Black, everybody. And you can do so by listening to Tim Black Show on YouTube, right?
Yeah. Just go to timblacktv.com and you'll find everything, my people.
Boom, boom, boom.
Tim Black.
Thanks for being on. We look forward to having you back, man.
That's it, man. I love you guys. You take care.
You too.
To the people.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we are joined by Tim Black of The Tim Black Show, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Elise Foley. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.